Welcome to the Cortana Analytics webinars. I'm your host Ashish Bhatia. I work as a Senior Program Manager at Microsoft. Today we again have Savine Reddy, Group Program Manager at Big Data Team in Microsoft. Savine was here a couple of weeks back and he talked about Data Lake and gave us an introduction into Data Lake. He's again here today to talk in depth about Data Lake and how we can leverage it. Before I hand it over to Savine, let me quickly get some of the bookkeeping items out of the way. It's a one-hour session. We will be recording this webcast, and we will send you a link to the recording after the live session. You can always come to the on-demand session after the live session and attend that as well. We will take up questions at the end of the session. It's a one-hour session. We'll do around 40 minutes of talking and pick up questions at the end. Feel free to put in questions at any point of time during the session, and we'll be looking at these questions as they come in. So with that, let me quickly hand it over to Sri.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm glad to be back here. I have a lot of really cool things to talk about today. Before I go through the slides, we probably won't be doing a demo, only for time constraints. I've already taken screenshots of demos and put them in the deck, so we'll cover details there that way. But we can do a demo if you want and time permits. So let me begin by just talking about what we're going to cover today. So largely there are two broad topics. We're going to talk about some backward-looking stuff and forward-looking stuff in terms of the origins of Azure Data Lake, in terms of Cosmos and what's coming there, and the future of Data Lake, okay? And then we're going to get the meat of today's webinar, which is what's actually in Azure Data Lake Analytics. Now, I will mention a little bit about Azure Data Lake Store at some point in this, but we're going to cover mostly Azure Data Lake Analytics and the topics that are parallelization, job scheduling, query execution, performance. And so the thing I'm trying to get across in this deep dive is that, you know, you have probably seen me or my colleagues give so many demos of use SQL and seeing the job graph and the job graph playback animation. And my theme today is really to go under the covers and what is it actually you're seeing? What's it mean, right? Because sometimes we gloss over those details, and there are a lot of details there that are quite interesting that will help you understand what's going on in Azure Data Lake and understand how people can use it. And most importantly, really at the end, is understanding how you trade off, you know, cost and performance. That's sort of a big deal here. Now, there are some topics I'm not going to cover. I just want to tell you what we're going to do here today. First of all, I won't be teaching you use SQL syntax. There are many sessions and presentations we have covering it, so you're expected to know a little bit of the syntax already. I'll be focusing on batch compute, which is what we offer in Azure Data Lake Analytics today. I won't be talking much about interactive streaming or machine learning because they're very different, and they really require you know, much deeper sessions. We only talk about use SQL. I won't be covering Hive. I won't be covering HD Insight. We will talk some about performance, but I won't go into specific numbers. I won't be comparing Azure Data Lake with other systems. And most of what I talk about will be around general availability. And I might mention a few things beyond general availability, but I won't go into great detail about them. And then I won't be doing any demos unless you really want me to. And finally, we're not going to be talking about using the SDK to automate pipelines and things. This is really a deep dive on really computation in Azure Data Lake Analytics. So now that we've prepared for that, let's just do a quick recap of some things from the last session. So first of all, there are three services in Azure Data Lake, and you know, we have Analytics and Store. Analytics and Store are public preview. They're going to be GA summer-ish, whatever your interpretation of summer is, in 2016. And you know, use SQL is a big language we're introducing there, which is all about being productive with a declarative use SQL combined with imperative C-sharp language that auto-parallelizes and auto-scales into big data. And today's focus will actually be showing you how that actually occurs. And again, we are currently working on, we have batch compute, which I'll talk about today, interactive computation, that is, you know, basically running a SQL or T-SQL query against big data. Something we're working on, it's in progress, and that's, you'll see previews of that later this year. And streaming machine learning are kind of future things. We are working on them. They're just not coming this year. And You know, just level set on uSQL for a second. Most of what I'm going to talk about is uSQL working with Azure Data Lake Store, which is something we offer today. And of course, you can see from this table, we support reading from other stores, and we write back to two of them. But the focus of today is really the top line, uSQL and Azure Lake Analytics computation against Azure Data Lake Store. That's a very specific set of performance that we need to know about. Okay, so let's backtrack and just talk a brief moment about history. How did we get here? And, you know, why should you believe this is a really good system? Well, you know, back in, I think, around 2008, the Bing team needed to build a system to understand user behavior, and they just had a lot of data. So they needed something that could do at a massive scale, and they needed to do something that kind of a very responsive system that was able to deal with changes, right? And finally, you know, generally speaking, we always wanted to do things at lowest cost. So they built Cosmos. Now, Cosmos is a system we have inside of Microsoft. The numbers are, you know, unreal how big the system is. But the ones I really want to focus on are, you know, the kind of workloads we have. Batch compute, interactive machine learning streaming, and we have, you know, over 10,000 developers using it. And the reason I have this slide is, you know, we're taking Cosmos, and what we've learned from building it and getting those, you know, thousands of developers productive, that's what we're bringing in Azure Data Lake Analytics. And the very things I'll talk about today about how computation works under the covers is exactly what Cosmos is doing. That's what we're bringing to you. So we'll go over some few key ADLA components to get started, right? Because this is sometimes a little bit of a source of confusion. So let's just start off with what's happening, right? When you get an ADL Analytics account, you always have to have an ADL store account. And it's what we call the default store, right? If you were to delete it, the ADL Analytics account is essentially non-functional. And it'll be more obvious in a moment why. But before we go into that, let's just take a look at what's inside the ADLA Analytics account. So obviously, there's the link to the stores. There are links to Azure Blob stores, if you have them. In this case, there are none. There's something called the uSQL catalog, right? And that contains metadata. Metadata here means it describes the system of tables and views and databases, okay? And if you see the diagram, there's a line going from the catalog into the store, because the metadata is in the uSQL catalog in the analytics account, but the actual storage of the data, the actual rows of the tables, are in are actually in the store account, the default store account. Now, besides that, there are some other things we got to talk about, which is the job queue. We'll go into great detail on that today, and some settings. The key settings for you to understand today are max concurrent jobs and max ADL used per job. And those are defaults for an account. When you create an ADLA account, those are set by default. Those can be changed, and what they mean we'll talk about later, but just open a support ticket and they can be changed. So let's now sort of go through the simplified workflow. This will be a framework that sort of controls what's going to be happening today. And this is a very simplified thing. There's many more layers here and pieces that I'm not going into, but this will give you a good sense of what's happening in the system. So when you submit a uSQL job into ADLA, it gets received at the very beginning by what we call the front end. And actually, you know, in some sense, there are several front ends. As you can see, one's the job front end, and then there's the metadata front end. And that front end parses that thing, the request, at a high level, just as an HTTP request, and figures out what to do, right? So it'll take the uSQL script, which is in the body, and any other parameters, like how much parallelism you want to allocate, and send that to a component called the job scheduler. And this thing does a couple of things. So first of all, its primary responsibility is to sort of figure out when the job can start, right? And does the job have enough resources to start? So it's going to place the job, before it places the job in a queue, it's going to compile the job. And it's going to call something called the compiler service, right? And the compiler service does all sorts of funny things we're going to talk about. But essentially, it does take a uSQL script and spits out some output, which will then be distributed into our cluster. Now, once the compilation has succeeded, the job will be placed into a job queue. We'll talk about that later. And then the scheduler is sort of waiting. It's basically waiting, and it's asking the YARN framework layer, are there enough resources to allow this job to start? And if there are, then the job will start. So what are resources? In this case, in the YARN framework, we're talking about essentially, are there enough virtual machines available to satisfy your parallelism request? then the job will start, and then it goes to the job manager. The job manager will actually be in charge of distributing the job across the cluster, like scheduling which machines will run which piece of the job. And what that means when I say pieces running in the cluster, we're going to superb amount of detail on that today. And then in the cluster on each VM, the uSQL runtime is executing a piece of the job, right? And that's called vertex execution. Now, I haven't introduced the word vertex yet. We will get to it a little bit later. So overall, this is the workflow we're going to go through. We'll go through each layer. Okay, now, the good way of approaching this is just taking a look at the user interface and then asking yourself, what is it we're seeing on the screen? This is a screenshot of Azure Data Lake Tools for Visual Studio, and I'm looking at just a very simple job. It's not especially big in terms of input or output, but the key question is, we've demoed this so many times, I want you, everyone on the call, to be able to look at this and understand its meaning, at least to a much greater depth than we've talked about before. So that's really what this presentation is about. And our key questions will be, what is that big green blob? Like, can you tell more about it? We always call it the job algebra, the graph. Like, let's just dig into it. And what's all those numbers on the left? What does it mean, right? And that's what the purpose of today's talk is. So we'll start with, remember the diagram? I said you submit a job to the front end and it goes and it gets scheduled, right? We're going to talk about the scheduling and the lifetime of a job and how things work there. So the job goes through several states, and you can see a screenshot on the left, and you can see that the user sees something called preparing, queued, running, and finalizing. And I'm going to explain everything what those mean. So that's what a user sees. So that's in green because the job has succeeded. And on the right, there are sort of two vertical stacks. And the one in purple is, roughly speaking, what you see as a user. And on the right, in the green, is what is actually happening underneath. Now, you can see they don't one-to-one correspond, and over time, maybe we'll simplify it. But I need to walk through those states because you'll learn, again, what's actually happening in the layers of the system. So we're going to start with the green, actually. And so a job enters the system, and it's in the state called new. And new lasts 0 seconds. I mean, it's just essentially a very temporary state. And then we enter the compiling phase, right? So that is the uSQL compiler is looking at the uSQL script and any other inputs you have in terms of DLLs, et cetera, and creating some output, the compile job. Now then, the job has succeeded in compilation, will be placed on a queue. Now, sometimes jobs will immediately start running, meaning they'll be queued for like 0 seconds, right? But in any case, whether or not it's being queued, the scheduler will decide when it starts, whether it be 0 seconds or some time later. And roughly speaking, the question the scheduler is trying to ask is, do we have resources to start running the job? That's a very simple question. And if so, let's allocate them and get the job started. And that's when the job will enter the starting state. Pretty simple. Finally, the job will run. Now, this is a weird case. There's actually two things going on here that the user sees, and I want to explain what's going on. And we'll cover in more detail why this is the case later. A job is in the underlying job state, it's running, but there are two user states, which are quite interesting. So let's split up the two cases. What's happening at the top is the first purple running state, what the user sees. In that phase, the job is actually, the pure computation is being done, right? So all the parts of the job are executing and they're done. And then we have this phase the user sees called finalizing. And we call that out just because sometimes people are a little confused why the job's computation is done, but the job hasn't finished yet, because it's in a state called finalizing. And finalizing means that the output of the job, which has been created in parallel fashion, is being stitched together into a single file. And that takes a few moments, not very long. Most jobs, finalizing is very quick. But it's important to note that because there can be a little bit of a discrepancy, especially when the sizes are really massive for your outputs. And finally, the job is ended, and ended could mean succeeded, failed, or canceled. So that's the overall sort of flow of job life. Let's move on then, and then see if I can advance. Okay, so I mentioned that a job is queued, and actually there are two reasons, and I'll describe those two reasons as local reasons and then global reasons. So local reason is that, well, there are already three jobs running. You've hit your max concurrency limit for a job. So of course, if you submit three jobs, the three will start running. You submit a fourth, the fourth job will be queued until one of the others stops. But there's a very, very rare case that can occur, right? And this is quite interesting. It could be that essentially we don't have, across the entire service, there just aren't enough VMs to start the next job for you. And that's one case. And the second case is that it's not a question of how many VMs are available, but you know, we want to guarantee an amount of bandwidth. A job isn't just compute, it's actually I/O. So we have to guarantee enough bandwidth for a job. And it could be the case that we have enough VMs, but the network is getting saturated and we don't have enough bandwidth to run your job. So in those cases, you know, if those cases are true, either one, then you can see a job queued even though you have no other running jobs, right? It's an extremely rare case, and you would not normally run into this at all. It just means the service is very busy. I just want to point this out because it is something that might occur in practice, but again, very, very rare. Now, just to prove to you I wasn't lying, if you look at the job in Data Lake Tools for Visual Studio, and you can click on this tab that's called State History, and you can see exactly what I'm saying. You can see the transitions from new to compiling to queued, et cetera. Okay, and then just to further illustrate the queuing and the status of jobs, on the right I have a screenshot of Azure Data Lake's analytics web portal, and you can see the jobs, and they have different icons for queuing, running, succeeded, or failed, right? Nothing too surprising there. Now, let's get into a little job queue. So the queue, you know, jobs enter the queue. They're always in the queue, even if there are no jobs running. And then they're selected for running. They're scheduled by the job manager. Now, the queue has a specific ordering. It's priority ordered. Now, the highest priority is one, meaning the most important. Lowest priority is our lower numbers, and typically the numbers range from 1 to 1,000. So a job with a priority of 1,000 is low priority. Job with priority 1 is higher priority. So jobs are ordered there in the queue, and they'll start running. And the queue can be about 200 jobs long, if needed. Now, a common question we get when we talk about job priority is, well, if I have three jobs running, which is the concurrency limit by default, and let's just say they have a very low priority, in this case, probably 1,000, and someone adds a new job into the queue, and it has a very high priority, what's going to happen? Well, some people expect that the new job, X in this case, will sort of kick off one of the other jobs and put the, let's say, A, B, or C back on the queue, and X will start running. That's not the case. Once a job has started running, it's going to keep running until it stops. So X, even though it has a higher priority, has to wait. So the key point here, again, priority in the queue does not preempt the job that's actually running. It only contains your ordering in the job queue. Okay, now we talked about getting the queue, and remember what happens just before you got in the queue was the job that had to get compiled. And understanding compilation will reveal a lot to you about what you see in Azure Data Lake. So compilation is, you know, it is not as simple as just feed in some MuSQL text and you get one file out. It's actually much more is going on there. I want to talk about that. So the MuSQL compiler actually is doing something you probably don't expect. Your MuSQL code is actually being translated, first of all, into an algebra, which is essentially an XML file, and the visualization of that XML file is that green graph you saw, the job graph. And there's also other files, but the two things of interest are that the compiler is actually generating C++ code, an actual CPP file, and a CS file, a C# file. And those, in turn, are being compiled to DLLs. Okay? So, you know, why do I bring this up? Because you've probably noticed that when you compile a MuSQL job, you know, it might take, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds to compile. And you're probably wondering, you know, why is it taking that time? And there are other reasons besides what I'm saying here, but one of the key factors here is the C++ compilation. So the C++ compiler is actually being used to generate part of the job. Now, you're probably wondering, why do we do this? Why is it we compile into C# and C++? Well, historically, the reason is this. We used to actually compile U-SQL scripts into C-sharp and then run the C-sharp compiler, which is very fast, by the way. So the managed DL was generated very quickly. However, we actually realized that if we could take the output of that DLL and run it as unmanaged code, we get somewhere between just an automatic 10 to 20% increase in job execution performance, right? So we did a lot of work, and now the U-SQL script is sort of split apart into parts that are just native code, and then we use managed code interop to talk to the C-sharp code if you provide libraries, et cetera. And so again, it's worth it, this extra compile time, because we're focused on doing big data. So, you know, paying an extra 30 seconds of compile time is worth it if you're doing, you know, processing, you know, 500 terabytes. So that'll explain some of the cost of compilation time. And over time, we hope we can actually make this much more efficient. And so the compile times will be faster again, because we recognize very convenient for you. But I did want to spend some time to explain that. Now, to prove I'm not going to lie, we're going to look actually at what we call the job folder. So whenever you submit a job, one of the things that ADL Analytics does for you is the job, meaning the input script, and all the things the compiler generated are saved for you. You don't have to turn this on. It's on by default. And it's saved in a folder in your default ADLS store, right? And the path is there. It's basically systems, job service, jobs, U-SQL, year, month, day, hour, and minute, and then the job ID, which is a GUID. And below, I've actually given an example of a real job in one of our accounts. So it looks just like this. And that job folder is there forever for you. You can delete it or not delete it. It's your choice. You control that folder. But what's in it? And if you look closer, you can actually see. Now, let's look at the labels that are gray. And roughly speaking, the labels that are gray mean these are things the compiler generated for you, right, from your script, right? And the blue labeled things are the things that you provided as a developer, right? So what did you provide as a developer? There are two things. You provided a request.script, which is the U-SQL script. And then notice, in this case anyway, the person who submitted the script provided two assemblies to use with the script, right? In this case, it's some helper thing called common job library, and then newtonsoft.json. So we can sort of presume that the script is using some JSON, right? And the rest of the files were generated by the U-SQL compiler, okay? So this is the contents of the job folders, and roughly speaking, sometimes we refer to a set of these files for a job as the job resources, right? It's all the files necessary to run the job, and especially focus on the ones the user provided. Now, in this case, the user provided DLLs. Actually, well, the user can provide more than DLLs. In fact, you could provide a text file that some user-defined operator in your job could read, right? That's a more advanced usage, but definitely possible. You could do things like provide, the runtime for Iron Python there and use that inside your code. So you have a lot of flexibility. You can say to the system, you know, here's some resources. And how these resources apply to job execution, we'll learn a little bit later as we talk about job execution and stages and vertexes. Okay, now let's take a look at Visual Studio again. I'm gonna click on resources, which is this little thing in the bottom left in ADL Tools for Visual Studio. And just notice the look at the top of the screen. You can download all the resources by clicking the download all link at the upper right. Also, look at the list on the left. So actually, there are more files here than I showed you just a minute ago. The blue files are the things I showed you. Basically, that's the output of the compiler, the job folder. And you can see there's a whole bunch of files that are in the gray. And I didn't mention them, and they're not in the job folder, by the way. And what are those gray items? Essentially, those are the U-SQL runtime bits. So what's happening here is everything in this folder will be sent when it's executing a job in all the VMs. Everything that you're seeing here will be sent to every VM that's going to execute the job. Okay, now that you understand that, we're going to go into how query execution works. That is how U-SQL scripts get translated into a mechanism that the cluster can execute and what's actually happening underneath. Okay, so this is a very popular slide in our team. called the Query Life. Now, roughly speaking, what's happening here is that from a tool like Visual Studio, someone has submitted through the front end a script, which goes through the job scheduler and the queue, just as I discussed before. And now what's happening is the compiler has generated the job graph, which is that weird-looking tree you see. And then the optimizer kicks in. Now, the optimizer is looking at that graph, and it's rearranging things in the graph. That's part one. That's what all optimizers do. The second thing is it's sort of rearranging things to so that the job can run efficiently in the cluster. And that's what those red arrows mean. The optimizer is actually looking at the data. It's looking at the nature of the data, how it's partitioned and distributed, where it is in the clusters physically. And it's telling the next stage of this system, which the operation is called vertex scheduling. It's saying, hey, if you run the job this way, you'll have more efficient performance. So an example of that is, in general, we will tend to move code to data, right? So all those resources I showed and the runtimes. Instead of copying the data to a VM where we have the runtime, which you might be copying, you know, 50 gigabytes to a machine, we'd rather, you know, copy the couple of megabytes of the runtime to that machine that has the 50 gigabytes, right? So we execute code near where the data is wherever possible. It's not always possible, but that's one of the optimizations we make. And the vertex scheduling is the thing that does that. If the data is local, it'll schedule it close to the work close to the data. If it's not, it'll have to read it, but it's responsible for cluster execution. And then finally, the entire cluster, the runtime is running the job, all the pieces of the job. And then later on, you can see the output using tools like the portal of the API. So very high-level view. We're going to go down in great detail now. So now we're going to look at these numbers. And we'll go back to the green thing. But before we get to the green thing, which is the job graph or algebra, we've got to talk about the numbers on the left. So there's one that says parallelism and the one that says vertices. We really need to understand what those numbers mean and how they relate to each other. So let's begin so the slide loads. Okay, so there's this button here on every job called the job profile, right? And the job profile, you know, what is it? So basically, the next section is going to understand what it means by to have the job profile. So you take a script, you generate a algebra, or we call the cluster or physical plan. And the way to think about that plan is it's a fixed amount of work that processes that input data that you specified. Okay? That's it. So it's a fixed amount of work. And now we're going to divide that fixed amount of work into pieces. So whatever the work is, meaning, you know, read these things and do this processing or transformation on them, is split apart, and we'll call each chunk of this work a vertex, right? And in total, it represents one piece of the entire work, and the number of vertexes for a job is essentially static, right? So if I have 100 vertexes, if I finish all 100, then the job is considered completely done and successful. Now, if I ask for, now DOP there, by the way, means degree of parallelism. In this case, it means how much the user allocated for the job. And in this slide, the user is asked for parallelism of 1, but there are, I think, about 18 vertexes. So roughly speaking, this is no surprise. As time goes on, only one vertex is active because only one ADLAU is available, right? That's what the user asked for. So the job is what we call very serialized now. Only one thing can go, and that's fine. Of course, things get interesting when someone is asked for a parallelism, a DOP of, let's say, 4 in this case. Now, what that roughly means is, if possible, 4 things at a time will happen. The 4 vertexes will execute. Right? Now, just a note, vertexes are not equally distributed, meaning some vertex may be processing way more data than another vertex. And correspondingly, that vertex may take longer than other vertexes, right? So keep that in mind. I've shown a very clear sort of progression through time here, but things can happen sometimes in stutters and starts, and sometimes extra time can be taken with one specific vertex. Okay, now vertexes are not equal in another way. They don't all operate on the same input data. They don't all do the same transformation. So, you know, we group them together into a thing called stages, or the official name is supervertex. If you've noticed previous diagrams, you may have noticed the names of the stages say SV aggregate or SV extract. Well, that's what the SV means. It stands for supervertex. It's a group of vertexes that do the same thing on the same data, right? Now, in this case, I have sort of drawn a three-stage job, and you can see that the first stage has most of the vertexes, the second has a medium amount, and the last only has two, right? Now, so, you know, execution will be, you know, proceed, let's say, to the degree of parallelism is four. Of course, four will go and be allocated. But, you know, I want you to think about the very last stage, right? If you imagine all the other stages, the two above were completely done, and we have four, a DOP of four, well, the last stage is quite interesting because at that moment, you've allocated for the entire lifetime of the job four ADLAUs. But in the last stage, only two can possibly be used, right? Okay, let's think about that. If the last stage lasts, 10 seconds, not much concern, right? It's a short amount of time, and you're wasting, you know, half the ADLUs. However, if that last stage is where a lot of time is spent, like let's say 90% of the time, then you're really wasting a lot of money, you know, compute time, just on the last stage. So you have to keep those kind of trade-offs in mind, and later on we'll sort of talk about understanding how to make those trade-offs. Okay, and another common sort of question we get is, do I have to finish an earlier stage before I get to the next one? And that's actually not the case. In fact, it's completely plausible, in fact, quite probable, that if you had a degree of parallelism of four or any, you know, greater than one number, you might see active nodes lower down in the stack later in the graph, right? We don't have to complete the first stage to get to the second stage, right? But it does mean that probably what happens here is that in the middle layer, those two active vertexes, they depended on data or the results of processing from some of the green vertexes in the first stage, right? And that's why they're allowed to start, because their inputs are ready. Now, we're going to look at the stage details. So this is, when I say stage details, you zoom in on one of the stages. Notice it says SV570. All the stages have numbers, by the way, the super vertexes. And in the Data Lake tools for Visual Studio, there's a UI button that says display, and you can drop it down, and there's, I think, seven different options. And I'm showing the one called progress, which is the default. And basically, let me just read out what's happening here. So first, the name. You know what SV means. You know what 570 means. There were probably about 500-something stages total in the job. Aggregate means something was aggregating in the stage. Not really a big surprise. So probably it was doing like a sum or a join or something, right? Sorry, not a join. It was doing a sum, an aggregation of some kind. Now, this stage itself uses 252 vertexes. So this, to get this part of the job done, can be parallelized up to 252 pieces, right? Now, the next number is 2.54 minutes. And what does that mean? That means that on average, and you really need to understand this is an on average, the average vertex execution time was 2.54 minutes, okay? It could be, note, that you had an outlier, like one vertex took way longer than the other, like it took an hour, but everything else was in seconds. And you can't detect that here, but there are tools later on in the ADL tools for Visual Studio that will help you understand this. And finally, how many rows did this stage go through? In this case, it's what? Just about 4 billion. And at the bottom, you can see in the stage how much was read or written, okay? So that's what a stage really is. And there are different views in Visual Studio on what a stage is. And I encourage you to look at those views. They're quite informative. Now, let's get real about distributed systems. Things fail all the time, right? A VM can crash because the underlying machine crashed. A hard drive can go bad. A router can be saturated. All sorts of things happen. And the more you distribute something, the more probable something will go wrong. So any distributed system, any big data system that does this has to compensate for failures, right? Because they happen, and you have to deal with it, and it's a way of life. The cool thing is NewSQL, this is completely hidden from you, right? So when you write your code, you don't have to worry about all these events because Essentially, each vertex is retried automatically. And you can see an example. Here's a screenshot of a stage. And there were seven vertexes in it. And this, you can see one of the bars here, right, which is like one of the seven vertexes. Now, what it's indicating here is that, hey, the vertex actually failed, right? But the key thing is it's not red. It's actually an orange. The fact that it's orange means, hey, we retried the vertex. And I think we'll retry it something like 5 or 10 times before we give up. So even though we failed for a moment, we tried again, and that stage completed. And the bigger your jobs are, the more you'll see this, right? So the overall stage completed. And this is, again, something you don't have to do for yourself. The system already handled this for you. Now, ADLA use. Now, by the way, we have different names for this, so I'm picking the one that currently I use most often. And it stands for Azure Data Lake Analytics Unit. So when you pick a parallelism number of N, that means you get N ADLAUs. So what is an ADLAU? Roughly speaking, it's a virtual machine with 2 cores and about 6 gigabytes of memory. Now, you know, I sort of always hesitate to show this slide because the truth is that, you know, as we upgrade the clusters, it may be you get a machine with 2 cores and 4 gigabytes of memory, right? And there's all sorts of optimizations we can do. But roughly speaking, this is what you'll get when you get an ADLAU. Okay, and now we're going to move into a phase where we'll talk about, you know, I told you how a job runs. I showed you how much you specify to pay for it in terms of parallelism. And I've shown you what vertices are and how they relate to parallelism, right? Now, the big focus is here on efficiency, okay? So let's try this for a second. I'm looking at the job, and I've clicked on the Diagnostics tab. And, you know, it says a couple of things here. It says profile isn't loaded, so it says 0 shallow issues found, and there's 2 green icons and 2 blue icons below it. And what it really means is, hey, I can't fully diagnose all the issues with your job until you load the profile. So we're going to click on, there's a button in the upper right-hand corner called Load Profile, which I've clicked here. And then now the profile is loaded. And now all this, you know, it says, hey, in this case, the job had no issues. Now there are 4 kinds of issues that are going to be investigated. I'm going to focus on the third one, which is called resource usage. Okay, so this is a real job. I asked for, as you can see, I asked for 5 ADLAUs. And that's, you can see a thin blue line at the top. That's the allocated number we asked for. And at the bottom, you can see the number of ADLAUs actually running. At the very beginning, you know, there are 0 because the system is kind of spinning up. You can see it spikes up, and you can see it sort of goes up and down. So this job didn't use a lot of ADLAUs all the time. Overall, you can see this job is what we call over-allocated, right? Let's take a look at another job, which is a real job that's much bigger. Has a very different kind of graph, and there's that blue line at the top. And again, now here's the active ADLAUs, right? And this is a little atypical for a job. Most jobs start sort of big, and they go down, they go up again, and they stop, or they go down again. But notice something interesting here. There's at least 2 points in the middle of job execution where essentially there was a very small number of vertexes active. In this case, I know there were 1 because I've seen the job. And you want to actually look in your job and think about that because, you know, when you see those dips, what you're saying is if those dips last a long time, what that means is your job is essentially doing something on only 1 vertex, right? And this is a sign you should think about debugging your job or optimizing or maybe splitting the job apart because, you know, if you're not using all your ADLUs, you're wasting time. Now, in this case, the amount of time where they're spending only a small number of vertexes is very small, so I'm not too concerned about this job. Overall, I would say it looks like 50% of the job is not being used, or ADLUs, but it's decent. And this was 1,000 ADLUs, by the way. And now, there's another tab here called Modeling. I've clicked upon this in ADL Tools for Visual Studio. And here, when you click on that tab, what happens is it tells you, based on an understanding of the job, hey, if you had typed in, not 1,000 ADLUs, but in this case, 2,425, we think your active number of ADLUs will show up like this, and it'll say, hey, look, this job will run in, it says 1410 seconds, which is 23.9 minutes, instead of the original time, which I think was like 45. So it's using a best guess. Now, this is not a perfect prediction. It's using some heuristics. This if you reran the job with exactly 2425, the graph would look kind of skewed in some ways. But I think this is a very valuable tool because it gives you some idea of the cost, the relative cost of things. But there is no substitution for just rerunning the job and getting a baseline and, you know, getting a baseline over and over. And then waiting for the next slide. Here's another example. I've actually entered now, in this case, 1,000. Now look at the predicted behavior of the job. You can see that the blue line, again, represents active ADLUs. Overall, the job is very efficient. Like, at any given moment, most of the ADLUs are active. However, now take a look. We predict it'll take 8,709 seconds, which means 145 minutes, which is 2-something hours, right? Again, not a perfect prediction. But this is a really great tool to understand how to trade off cost for query latency, right? In some cases, you don't care if the thing takes 2 hours because the workflow it's supporting for your users is a daily workflow. So you're much happier paying very little over a long period of time. And then now this raises the topic of the cost. What's the actual cost for an ADLAU job? The formula is very simple, actually. Job cost is 0.5 cents plus the amount of compute. So every job costs at least half a cent. I'm sorry, I have this mistake. It's actually 5 cents, not 0.5 cents. And there's number of minutes of the compute time for the job times the number of ADLUs times the ADLU per minute cost. Now, all this is on our Azure pricing page, so you can exactly know how much you'll be charged for a job. But knowing that, again, you know, you should take a look at, understand allocation, which is, again, the blue line, right? So you're going to pay, if this job had 100 ADLUs at 10 minutes, that's 100 ADLU minutes, okay? You're paying for that cost, even though, you know, as you see in the next chart, if you actually used only, you know, this kind of curve here, you're not paying for the area under the curve, the red curve. You're paying for the box, the area under the blue line, right? So keep that in mind. As you start going into big data with ADLA, you have to start looking at these graphs and just checking and just verifying, you know, could I make things better? Am I overspending, right? In this case, if I saw this graph on a job, I would look back at previous instances of the job and see if there's a habitual pattern with the job. And then I would test it. I would lower the allocation as an experiment and see what happened, right? So this is a thing you should always keep in mind with ADLA. Okay, I know we're at 10:45, so I'm going to run through the next slides relatively quickly. And this is about how ADLA works with parallelism. Now, it's important to understand this because ultimately it'll help you understand your cost. So the first thing you have to understand is the store. So the store, just like many big data stores, if you have a very big file, the file is chunked up into small pieces, and we call those extents. We may have a new name. I actually don't know if we have renamed this. But the extents are triplicated. Now, in this case, this file has 5 extents. If you had a terabyte file, there might be, I don't know, millions of extents. But I'll keep it simple and diagram and have 5. Each extent is replicated inside that data center 3 times. So we have 3 copies. So, for example, if a Vertex is reading the data from extent 1 and the machine it's reading from is unavailable or goes down, it'll get rescheduled to read the data from extent number, the second copy of extent 1. Right? That's another way we have not only just a highly reliable store, but we make compute reliable as well. And another facet of this, which makes this interesting, is if you have a file that's split apart like this, it enables performance in terms of parallelized read. So multiple extents can read from the same file, different pieces of it. Now, in addition to parallelized read, you also have parallelized write. And an example of this is you have a web service with a bunch of front-end machines. Each are creating log files on their own machines, and they'll use APIs to append to a single Azure data lake file. These are like simultaneous uploads appends. And that's how you can end up with a file that's, you know, like 100 terabytes, right? You didn't upload it from a machine. It's being built by parallel writing. So again, this is another sort of performance thing. Now that we've gotten the store out of the way, we'll talk about, you know, sort of basic levels of parallelism. Waiting for the slide to load. Okay, so a small file, which is, let's just say, 1 megabyte, can only be parallelized into one vertex, right? That's pretty obvious. Nothing too unusual about that. If you have a bunch of small, so how do you create more parallelism? Well, your first technique with a bunch of small files is, okay, I'll have multiple small files. Therefore, I'm guaranteed at least one vertex per file. Okay, that's cool. Now we'll take into account what we learned previously about data lake store, and we realize a very large file has multiple extents. Therefore, the number of extents you have in that file opens up the opportunity for more parallelism. Right? So when you combine both effects together, multiple files and they're big files, you get many, many vertexes, right? So the size of your file and how many physical files you have control how many vertexes you have. And there are more beyond that, but it's a simple way of explaining it. Now, to understand performance and how ADLA helps you, let's take a look at what it would take to process a single file. It's a large text file, and this text file is, we could say, it's a very simple schema. It's a session ID, a domain, like this is like a search engine, and how many times people clicked on links in this, right? So in this case, in session one, the guy clicked on Facebook and the whitehouse.gov, 5 times for Facebook, 14 for White House. And just imagine this is not, you know, 10 rows. Imagine this is like several billion rows, okay? Very simple data set. All we're going to do is take a look at how that would be sort of laid out on the store. Now, this is cleaner than actually it should be, because, you know, you don't know where the Facebooks are. They're scattered across all the extents, and you might have a million extents, okay? And same with all the other things. The domains are everywhere because that's how the data came in, from 1,000 different web front ends. What happens, and this is what we call an unstructured file, what happens if we try to extract that data and just count the number of clicks by domain? Very simple use SQL script shown here. And let's just see intuitively what will happen. Okay, so first of all, here's the output. This is the answer we'll expect. And let's take a look. This is not a job graph exactly, but it's sort of related. Think about, so instead of Facebook, CNN, etc., I'll use ABC, right? Now take a look what's happening here. The domains are everywhere. We can do a read in parallel, of course, because that's how many physical pieces we have. But each piece can only do a partial aggregation, right? Now, each sort of worker here knows the totals for A, B, and C, but you have to bring all the A totals together, and that is, you have to bring that phase together, and that's called partitioning, and these crossed lines are what we call data shuffling, right? Now, each node has the full aggregation, so all the sums for A are in one place, all the sums for B are in one place, all the sums for C are in one place, and we can write. So the key part here is just look at that middle layer with all the crossed lines. That's really expensive. It's really expensive because there's a lot of I.O. If that was, you know, hundreds of terabytes, that's going to be a very slow job. Okay, and of course, by the way, there's a parallel write at the end. Okay, now we'll try a different case. Let's improve it using the USQL catalog. So I'm going to create a table, and notice the red line, clustered by domain. What that means is, hey, USQL, try to physically partition the data by domain. Okay, and I'm going to fill that table with the data. Let's take a look at how the data is actually split apart. Now it's quite different. The Facebook records are now physically together, and the White House records are physically together. And you can just see from the picture, it looks a bit cleaner and more organized. But this has an immense impact on performance, right? One of the keys, it is this. Take a look at how we read now. Very different. The domains are partitioned together, which means that There's no shuffling whatsoever. Everyone can read and do the full aggregation and do the parallel write, and we're done. This would have an amazing impact on performance, right? And this is why, you know, you need to know this technique, right? Because it'll mean that, you know, people who are trying to use ADLA can get the best out of the system. So I'm going to just wrap it up with some high-level performance advice. Just to, you know, make sure people first, you know, the biggest mistake people make with USQL are actually covered by the first two points. Because it's very C-sharp friendly, people tend to, when they're kind of puzzled by something, they tend to start using USQL and then suddenly shift to using C-sharp, and by creating custom joins and custom reducers. And, you know, it's definitely possible. And those are UDOs, user-defined operators. But, you know, when you do that, you really reduce the ability for the system to parallelize and optimize your code. So that leads my second, these two points. First of all, you should really learn USQL, right? If you're not sure how to express something in a USQL way, you know, ask. It should be very rare that you create a UDO. And you know, I say UDOs are evil because, you know, I got to assure you, if you don't, if you're going to write your own custom join, the odds are not in your favor that you'll do a better job than our optimizer engine will, right? We will do a better job 99.99% of the time. So be very cautious about extending the language with custom reducers and combiners. Very dangerous in terms of performance. Now, there are some, not all UDOs are evil. An extractor or an outputter, very simple UDOs, very easy to get those right. But the complex ones like reducers, combiners, hard to get right. And finally, understand your data, right? The more you realize about how much data you're coming in, the sizes, how they're distributed, and I show you why that was important, you know, the more performant your jobs can be. And I'm almost finished. I just want to send one more note about performance, about benchmarks. You know, please keep in mind that ADLA, Store and Analytics, they're both in preview. So, you know, sometimes people will just copy and paste some SQL code and expect it to work exactly the same way. And, you know, they work differently. They're optimized differently. And finally, you know, do keep in mind that ADLA, Store and Analytics are about big data, and we're talking about batch computing. So, you know, sometimes we'll get people who want to, they'll try to process, you know, a 10 or a 1 gigabyte file, and you'll notice that, you know, SQL might be faster in that case. And you might reach some odd conclusions about that, especially when you combine that with not optimizing in a way that USQL understands. So really the thing is here, if you're going to do benchmarking, contact us, right? I wouldn't recommend doing it right now because it's in preview, but in the right ways of looking at the performance, right? Don't go against a small data set and form a conclusion about performance. No, reach out to us and we'll help you understand. Okay, I think we can open up for questions.
Thanks, Savin. Let me look for some questions. Do we have a yield job feature to keep some of the jobs temporarily on the hold for a high priority job?
Okay, so for the rest of the audience, yield job essentially means pause the job for a while. And the answer for that is no, we do not have that in ADLA. It's something we're considering for the future.
Great. Another question. Are you able to use ADLA on several ADLS simultaneously?
So the answer to the question is yes. An ADLA account can read and write from to multiple ADLS stores, even in the same script.
Great. Do you plan to include more extractors for JSON or XML files?
Currently, we have those as samples available on our GitHub repository. It's an active question whether we'll actually incorporate them as built-in samples. If you really want that, please go to http://aka.ms/adlfeedback and put that in as a request.
Okay, great. Are you planning to support R?
Eventually, we want all the Cortana Analytics suites to work very well with R. We just haven't nailed down our plans for R support yet.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between SQL 92 in SQL Server and uSQL, and why create uSQL?
Well, the key thing about uSQL is, first of all, it is a language that is increasingly more and more like T-SQL. The second thing is that one of our things we learned in building Cosmos is that the language has to get much more agile with what developers want. So, for example, what our developers told us is that they really are comfortable with C-sharp code. They want that C-sharp expression language built into SQL. That's one key differentiator between uSQL and T-SQL. And the second thing is that as a result of that, uSQL is much more easily customizable and extendable than T-SQL. And our feedback from most developers is that it's a very happy space for them. They feel very productive in it, much more than a T-SQL developer. That isn't the diss T-SQL. I know there are many people who find it very productive. But for the kind of things we do and how agile we need to be, we need a language that is sort of supports those user behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Another question is there a way to call jobs from within SSIS?
So in general, when you say call jobs, I think people are meaning schedule jobs. If that's what's meant, the answer is, I'm not an SSIS user. However, we support we have a .NET SDK that I believe can be used from SSIS. So in that sense, SSIS could schedule a job.
Mm-hmm. Another question, which is, what are some of the differences between running uSQL over ADLA and HiveQL over HD Insight Cluster? Why would I use one setup rather than the other?
But I should reveal one more thing. Remember, we're going to add Hive into ADLA as well, right? So it's good to think about Hive in ADLA and uSQL in ADLA, and why is it different from Hive and HD Insight? Primarily, if you want to do a pay by query instead of running clusters, you would prefer to use Hive or uSQL in ADLA. The second thing is that ADLA is much more scalable than HD Insight. HD Insight, clusters can be, large, but the scale of ADLA is much, much larger, right? So, for example, I ran a job that was 1,000, on-demand 1,000 ADLA use. And if for an HD Insight cluster, that would be allocating, 1,000 nodes.
Probably the last question that I'll pick up. Can Azure Spark Cluster access ADLA store?
Can a Spark Cluster now? Yeah, the answer is that is coming. That does not work yet. So we've started with making Hadoop HD Insight be able to talk to ADLS. That works today. It'll get simpler in the future. And the next is to open it up to other HD Insight cluster types.
Cool. Thanks, Shaveen, for a great presentation. I'll stop taking questions at this point of time. One of the things I would like to mention is, remember, this is a four-part series on Azure Data Lake. We just done two of these. Two of them are coming in the forthcoming weeks, so look out for those announcements. You could already go to the Cortana Analytics webinar site and register for those sessions there. We will be sending you the presentation and the recording as a follow-up email. And please answer some of those questions in the poll. It'll help us make these sessions more effective for you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Have a good day. Bye-bye.